You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
Last week, I spoke on a panel with Vanessa King-Ori, celebrating International Women's Day. Listening to Vanessa that evening, it became apparent that it really wasn't necessary for the rest of us to be there. It was her views on social justice, women in business, creativity, and leadership that everybody wanted to hear, most of all me. Her path towards Chief Business Officer of Condé Nast International is a story of a young girl from Kenya achieving remarkable amount in a British world through sheer intelligence, motivation, and determination. This we all know, but for me, the revelation was when Vanessa began talking about the food of her family, her culture, especially the cooking of her grandmother. Today, we're here together to hear more about memory and food, change and connectivity. As always, I will listen with awe, with love, and deep admiration. The recipe that you chose.
Yes.
You love artichokes.
I love artichokes, and I love that you can only have them for a certain time of the year properly. Yeah. And Italians do them incredibly well. I hope I pronounce this correctly, but it's for carciofi alla piperno. You want to explain a little bit about the piperno element?
Well, first of all, carciofi, they're also called carciofi, which is a word for artichoke in Italian, alla Giudea. And there's an area of Rome, which is called the Jewish Quarter, which I suppose, like in many Italian cities, was a ghetto. Mm. And it's right near the Colosseum. And there's a restaurant there called Piperno. Mm. And Richard and I used to go there. It's on the sort of top of a little hill, and you actually can overlook the Campanilia. And it's just a great little restaurant, and like a lot of Italian restaurants, you go there for one reason, you know. One dish. And so there it's the artichokes alla Giudea, and we call them for the cookbook artichokes alla Piperno, because that's the name of the restaurant.
Yeah, so
we have to go
nice.
There. It's good.
Well, I mean, Piperno, get ready to be absolutely swarmed with
exactly.
Ruthie's recommendation.
It's still there. It might not be there anymore, but we'll see.
Okay, so this recipe serves six. You need 12 Romanesco artichokes, sunflower oil, sea salt and black pepper, and 3 large lemons. Right, so you heat the oil to 100 degrees in your deep fryer. You need to have a deep fryer, first of all.
Well, you can use a large saucepan with olive oil.
Peel away the leaves of the artichoke, cut the stalks 2 centimeters from the head. Fry the artichokes in batches until the leaves begin to crisp and the hearts soften. Drain on kitchen paper. When cool, peel off the outside leaves, trim the tops of the artichokes, increase the temperature of the oil to 170 degrees. To fry the second time, this is a healthy one, place
in... No. It does drain off the oil, I have to say. It's not...
It's tasty. Okay. It's healthy and love.
Yeah.
So to fry the second time, you place 2 to 3 artichokes at a time in a hot oil and fry until crisp for about 2 to 3 minutes. Then flatten out the artichokes, set each on a board, and gently separate out the layer of the head, exposing the heart. Squeeze between 2 plates, season and serve with lemon. What an amazing recipe.
It's rather nice that an artichoke has a head and a heart.
So, I was thinking about myself in this.
What do you eat at Vogue? Do you stop for lunch?
It depends. So I'm very lucky because I entertain a lot our clients and business partners. So we go out to, we're in Mayfair, and we go out to lovely Mayfair restaurants. So I'm at Scott's a lot, Claridge's. I love the Mount Street restaurant and things, which I all now associate with work.
Yeah.
Right. But then there are lots of days where I'm doing the business end. So I don't leave my desk all day, and my assistant will go and fetch me a salad or some sushi. I try to eat raw food in the day. But the way it is at Vogue House is each magazine kind of dominates a floor. Mm-hmm. So I worked on GQ for years. I was mm-hmm. running that business and mm-hmm. That's the first floor, and then you graduate up and Vogue is the fifth floor. And there was always this idea that nobody eats at Vogue, you know. Yeah. So people would deliver, you'd see in the reception of Vogue House, you know, cakes and these amazing things being delivered, and we'd all sort of scoff, oh, well, you know, mm-hmm. they'll be in the bin, no one eats them up there. And, you know, at GQ, we all sort of, there was food everywhere all the time, you know. And actually, it's a big misconception because we work really hard. It's a really hard-working team, yeah. The Vogue team. Now I'm overseeing all of the brands at Condé Nast, but I still sit with Edward on the fifth floor. And he loves to eat.
Yeah, he does.
We love to eat.
Yeah, that's good.
We love to plan a dinner. We love to incorporate a bit of our culture into dinner. So even when we did his wedding... His wedding was at Longleat, and I helped him to plan that, and it was amazing. But we were saying, you know, we need to have jollof in there. Which caterers can go out and cook some jollof rice?
Did you?
We did. Good. And we had, you know, he loves spicy food. Anytime he comes here, he'll always say, can I have chili and chili oil and da-da-da. So we had chili sauces and everything. So it's talking about food, eating. A lot of times he and I will eat our lunch at desks, at, you know, across from each other. So he'll have steamed vegetables and, you know, some fish or chicken or something, and I'll have sushi, but we sit together and eat it if we're doing a working lunch. Otherwise, I'm out with clients.
When we talked to Edward Hennefel, and he spoke quite a lot about wanting to change the culture of, you know, the stick-thin model and the denial of food and the denial of pleasure, and in order to show clothes at their best. Now that you're in such a senior position at Condé Nast, does that enter your world?
Yeah.
What do you feel about it?
Well, I think that, you know, the reason that Edward and I's partnership kind of is so important to me is we had been separately and a bit together talking about this challenge in our industry, not just about beauty being about stick thin, which is kind of a bit preposterous, but just the idea that magazines and media represented this kind of one really hard to reach version of being a woman, which we didn't grow up surrounded by. My friends weren't those people. And yet there were these magazines that we loved representing that, and an industry which we loved and we were a part of, you know. And so, you know, the joy and beauty for both of us was all around in different shapes, in different sizes, in different color. And what we did behind the scenes at Vogue was build a group of people who didn't think like us. That's how you learn about new, exciting things. If you're all speaking to each other and you know, Edward and I actually have quite similar backgrounds. I was laughing with Steve McQueen about our mothers did exactly the same thing, nurses in the same hospital.
The two mothers?
Yeah. And so our background, you know, he can start a sentence, I can finish it, because our backgrounds are so similar.
Yeah.
And so what's really fascinating is talking to, I mean, I could talk to Steve forever and a day, or Edward forever and a day. But what I really love is to talk to people who didn't grow up like me. That's where, and I think that's what I really want to challenge not only the media industry, but any organization to do a little bit more is, you know, how can you connect with people and wider audiences if you don't have them in your midst?
And food?
And food is the great connector. Well, food's a
Steve McQueen's a good eater. We did an interview with him, and he remember him talking very much about growing up, like you.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting conversations about his mother and the markets, and, you know, keeping the food of their of their parents and their grandparents, and adapting to the food of the culture. You know?
The keeping food alive through food is everything. You know, when everything was planned around food. I remember all of our great excursions on the weekends being about going to get food, you know. So particularly in London in the 90s, late 80s, 90s, where a lot of the foods that we ate in the Caribbean in particular were not readily available. You couldn't pop to, you know, Sainsbury's. So you'd go from West London to Dalston Market because somebody told you that there was something there or what have you. And Wembley Market. We used to go to Southall Market lots because the Indian community had lots of the ingredients and spices and so on that we used. And so that's really unifying. But I think with one of the best ways to get to know people and groups of new people when you're trying to connect and create these kind of diversity of perspective spaces where, you know, is through food.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Where were you born? Start from the very beginning.
I was born in Kenya, in Nanyuki. My father is Kenyan and my mother is from St. Kitts in the Caribbean, St. Kitts and Nevis, a tiny little island. Mm. And they met here in London. It's kind of a strange pairing in the 70s. And it was quite a radical relationship theirs because at that time, Africans and people from the Caribbean did not spend that much time together. They certainly didn't end up in relationships. And London is the great sort of unifying space, right? Mm. It's a true melting pot, I think, in the world. They met here, they fell in love. And my mother moved with my father to this strange land where she knew no language or the culture. Lots of her family didn't speak to her because of the move, and indeed lots of his family didn't speak to him.
Because married someone from...
From a different culture. Yeah. And he was a very eligible bachelor. So I was born in this kind of context.
Well, had they both planned to come to London for a short time and then go home? Or did that...
My father...
What did he do?
He did some of his education here. He was a military man, but he studied engineering, came to London with studies and work and things. Mm. And my mother, who is a great inspiration in my life, was... moved here at 17 on her own. She took the flight and came to London to become a nurse with the NHS. And it was a time where British were recruiting heavily in the Commonwealth to establish the welfare state, so to come and become nurses and bus drivers and all of those things. And she had a big kind of dreamy heart and came here thinking this is going to be an incredible life.
And then she was transported to
Kenya.
Was it a small village?
It's quite a small village, yes, and it's in a sort of mountainous area. His family were in coffee, so quite rural, but they were very well off. But my mother had a very difficult time settling in there, and this is where food comes in, because she was encountering women who didn't understand her, literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
She only spoke English, and they often spoke five languages, you know. And so the language barrier was there. She didn't speak Swahili. She didn't speak the dialect as well. And so food was her way to connect with people. She used to say to me, it's quicker to learn a dish than to learn a language.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most ingratiating things you can do in a new culture is, you know some basic words to greet people. And she looked at food in the same way. If you could cook the food really well, it was a show of respect. Yeah. So she learned to cook, which I also found strange because she had cooks and nannies and all of those things, but she loved to cook.
Mm. Had she loved to cook before she went there? She
grandmother was a great cook. And
grandmother in St. Kitts.
Yeah, so we're all over the place.
Yeah.
And my family are not a family who say I love you a lot, but we're an incredibly loving family, and it's expressed through stories. Like, everyone in my family is a bit of a joker. Like, you know, funny stories and food. Mm. Yeah, she...
What was the kitchen like? Do you remember the kitchen in the house?
Well, I didn't... We left Kenya when I was 18 months old.
Oh, I see.
I don't have any real memories. But again, she would cook the dishes to keep, I guess, the Kenyan in me alive. So we left when I was 18 months old. We moved to St. Kitts and then we came to London. And she would cook ugali and sukumawiki and mung beans. And these are Kenyan dishes.
What are the first two? I know mung beans, but what were the two dishes?
So sukumawiki is, it's like collard greens or kale with tomatoes and onions, and you tend to have it with rich dishes, so like a beef stew or stewed mung beans, and ugali, which is like a maize kind of, it's almost like a, not a mashed potato, but it's quite a firm, dense carrier almost for stews and things, and the sukumawiki is like a palate cleanser. So she would make these dishes for us, my sister and I guess, to keep that Kenyan culture alive in us. Growing up, moving around, living in, belonging to three places, food was a brilliant connector to places we'd left so that they didn't become lost, but also a really good way of connecting with somewhere new, with new people, with new communities, and with a new life, almost.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Well, okay, so at two, we went to live with my grandmother. Mm. My mother and father got divorced. My mother came back to London to try and reestablish herself, buy a house and all of those things. And we stayed in St. Kitts with her visiting frequently with my grandmother. So I was very young, so I was stuck to her all the time. Mm. And she is definitely the most powerful sort of figure in my life. My mother's a very powerful figure. Mm. We're very close. But my grandmother is almost my heart, you know. And I, gosh, I'm welling up even talking about her. It's because when we spoke about
she's
this on
still
the
past, alive.
No, she's not. But she's very much alive in I think about her every day, not only through food, but also just her advice was amazing. Gosh, it's so funny. It's really evocative thinking about this. I'm getting emotional.
Okay, do you want to stop?
No.
Okay. You know, both of us cry.
It's kind of happy tears.
Yeah,
you know,
of course it is. Yeah.
When someone leaves a mark on your life that's so powerful and kind of runs through everything, in my working life, whenever I'm up against any kind of challenge, in the way I raise my son, in the way that I connect to people and what I place as important, these kind of figures are so strong. And I miss her. I really miss her, but she's alive.
What was her food like? Describe. Was she in the kitchen all day long?
I don't remember her not wearing an apron or some sort of overalls. So she made food that was needed constant nurturing, you know. Her house was also where everyone dropped in. Mm-hmm. So my sister and I lived there. On and off, four of my cousins lived there, my uncle's children. And then she was sort of everyone's grandmother. So her house was, it was so fun. It was awash with children all the time. And I was the youngest, so I was always with her. I slept in her bed and I was literally on her apron strings. So her food was very rich. It was like almost like a warm embrace, you know, hearty and lots of sort of stews and meats and heavily marinated, delicious comfort food, dumplings and, you know, sort of starchy, delicious things. And she kept her own little farm. At least it felt like a farm to me. She grew her own vegetables. She had her own fruit tree. She would graft her own strains of mango. She grew herbs and things that people would come and visit her to buy. And she kept her own animals. And I used to help her tend to those little gardens. And then she'd make up these amazing dishes from food. And she'd tell me stories of the food as well. So
did she grow up in poverty or did she grow up in...
Yes.
She did. Yeah.
And I look at sort of my life now, which is so much on her shoulders and all of the opportunity I have now. And I think about how important circumstance is. So she was a really intelligent woman. She was the most prolific reader I ever knew. She was either cooking or reading. But she was forced to leave school at 14. Her mother was a... she also had a slightly strange parentage in that her father was previously a slave, and her mother was...
So your great-grandfather was a slave?
Yeah.
In St. Kitts?
Yeah.
And so what year would that have been? That would have been probably...
Goodness.
Well, like the Civil War, probably
yes.
late 1800s. Yeah.
But her mother, which is really strange, was a Portuguese woman from a slave-owning family. So it's really, really unusual that way around. And her mother was not very maternal at all. And so they fell upon hard times. Her mother was seen, I think, as having made bad decisions. And so she didn't grow up surrounded, as I understand it, by lots of love. And so she created this love, loving well. But the reason that it's important how she grew up is her food was very much worker food. You know, she made food that they would have made for men and women who worked picking cotton. She was picking cotton at 14 years old in the fields. And then after that, taking books under the house to read them in the evening and cooking and supporting, you know, the households and so on. So she had this really eclectic upbringing where she really valued education and missed her opportunity, I think, to have a full education. But food was also the key joy.
Yeah. And so would you sit down, would you go to school and then every evening come home and sit down for dinner? Would that be a dinner on the table for you at
yes,
home?
Yes, yeah. So my grandmother always liked us to sit and eat together, again, because I think sharing stories and storytelling was really important, and food's a really good way to get everyone together and understand what their days were like. I was very young, so I was always around the house, so I looked forward to people coming home with their stories of the day and enjoying that over food. And so we would have great mounds of kind of rice and vegetables and these kind of incredible, and everybody would pile in and pour in and go for second plates. It wasn't a very formal sit, and the table was also off the kitchen. So it was kind of part of the action. And it was just a really lovely way to be connected with the people around you.
Yeah. And breakfast? What was breakfast like? Do you remember?
Do you know what's so funny? I do not remember breakfast. Mm. What I remember really, really vividly at my grandmother's house is the back door of her house was at the base of a, we called it a mountain, but it was really just a big hill. And there were mango groves and things. And so we would take buckets in the morning. We'd just run out barefoot, all the kids together with the older kids, and go and pick fruit and slightly gorge ourselves on the and things.
Mangoes. So you left this kind of... Your mother took you to London then, did she?
Yeah. So my mother, while we were having this lovely time, you know, with my grandmother, learning these amazing lessons about life and opportunity and food and, you know, all of those things. My mother was in London toiling away. She was very focused on us moving to London and having the kind of cultural access that you could have in London. Being part of different communities was a big thing for her, and getting a really, really great education. So she was working very hard. She'd managed to, on a nurse's salary, buy a three-bedroom house in West London, which was her dream, and all while coming back every 3 months to St. Kitts to visit us. But this sort of sad thing happened where she became this kind of glamorous figure in my life, but I didn't really connect that we were ever going to live together. So when we came to London, it was a bit of a rude awakening, to be honest. Like, I miss my grandmother terribly.
Had you ever experienced either in Kenya or in St. Kitts any form of racism? You probably hadn't, had you?
No. Yeah. That was also really strange to me. I'm also really grateful for that, because when I did encounter any forms of racism, it just didn't touch my soul because it just seemed preposterous, you know. The idea that I could be anything, bad or good, just because I'm black was silly, because I'd come from these cultures where everyone's black, good, bad, and everything in between. And so I think I'm really, with retrospect, grateful to that foundation where I was never affected deeply by any kind of racist comments and things like that. It just felt a bit silly. I went to Catholic schools where there's a lot of immigrant communities anyway, lots of Irish Catholics, Italians, Eastern Europeans. And so there was that unity and difference anyway. And then I definitely remember two encounters in primary school. I told my mother and she was, of course, came down to the school and frustrated, but it just didn't really, really affect me. Yeah. I think the comments don't affect me as much as seeing injustice. Yeah. So more discrimination, but I couldn't understand that until later on.
Yeah.
But I was very lucky to be surrounded by lots of people who had their version, of the kind of immigrant experience. The other thing was, my mother is an incredibly charming woman. Like, everybody loves her. Mm. She just brought people together all the time. And so our house was always filled with quite people from all different backgrounds. And again, I'm really grateful to that now. I tend not to walk into spaces and feel uncomfortable. I don't mind being the only person I don't mind being the only woman in the room or the only person of colour or whatever. I think that's because of her, because she was hard not to like. And I remember my mother used to host these dinners and Sunday afternoons, and you'd have, her nursing friends, the High Commission of St. Kitts would be casually there, and like other sort of dignitaries at our little house, and these people, the woman from the council estate around the corner who sometimes helped to pick us up from school because she was working and things like that. And she just threw everyone together and served up food. Mm. And
did she adapt her cooking when she came here? Did she change to more British cooking, or did she keep the cooking of Kenya? And
she kept the cooking a lot of St. Kitts and Kenya. But she did, we did do these sort of English nights. So Fridays we'd have like British food. And we thought it was really exotic.
What was it?
We'd have egg and chips.
Oh yeah, for breakfast or for dinner?
No, for dinner, which this was so bizarre to us, that's like, wow, potato and an egg and that's the whole meal. Yeah. And lots of different sort of cuisines that you could get here, which you couldn't get so readily in St. Kitts and things. Yeah. So Fridays and sometimes Saturdays were our days to either eat out, or she'd recreate, frankly, with much more flavour.
Yeah.
But she cooked, and I remember everybody loved her food.
Yeah.
I always thought when my friends came to my house, they came to see her rather than came to see me.
Yeah.
That's cool. I felt a
little
bit.
And would you go to other people's houses for food? Would it be very different from your own?
Yes. Yeah. And it was such a culture shock. I always love to go. I have a very close friend of mine is Polish, and she, in her house, her grandmother had a sort of annex in her house, and she was blind, actually, her babcia. And we became very close. And now I think about it, it's probably because I never really made the connection of my relationship with my grandmother. But she would teach me to make pierogies and all of these amazing sort of Polish dishes, which I would never have eaten before. And I would have Irish stews at, my Irish friend's house. I had a friend called Margaret who had, she was one of 13. I found initially the food really bland, and my first encounter with English food was at school. So it's kind of, the worst.
Yeah.
And then it sort of London opened up to me through having these experiences with different families from different immigrant backgrounds and how they cooked and so on. So that was really important, me falling in love with being in London after arriving in that cold October and feeling ripped away from my favourite place.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
The idea of Vogue was that it was at the time that Edward took over exclusive, really in an excluding way, unfortunately, which was, you know, the style of the time. But the idea that you would critique the industry, which was our bread and butter. So the business of Vogue is advertising from luxury fashion brands who at the time celebrated very thin, very white, a very particular youth and a very particular type of beauty. So although everyone loved Edward's idea and vision, there was also this almost unanimous sort of gulp and
fearful.
Very fearful. This is going to destroy the business of Vogue.
I remember before the first issue, all the talk about, you know, the change and how the vision of yourself and of Edward. And that first issue was amazing,
so
wasn't it? Tell me about that first issue. And it kind of does relate to food, doesn't it? This podcast is about food.
Yeah, it's true. I think it's very much about joy. And if you deny yourself anything, right, you deny yourself getting older. You deny yourself gaining a few pounds for the joy of food. You deny who you are in terms of your demographic makeup. It's not joyful. And so that's what I read. That's what I articulate from what Edward's vision was. And it was also my shared vision, you know. In everything I've described about how I grew up, it's about great storytelling. It's about joy. It's about connection. It's about acceptance of difference. And so this just spoke to me.
It also instills a sense of failure if you're not, you know.
Yes.
So damaging to women growing up, that sense of failure if you don't fit into what it was, you know.
You know what was so incredible in that first year is, so Edward and I went on this mission where he basically said, you know, if this doesn't make money, then I'm not going to be doing this for very long. I know I can do what I need to do and people will love it, but I need to be able to do it for a while. And no one can see a path to making this business work. And so I set about creating a new business. Mm. And it was scary stuff because Vogue is half of Condé Nast's business. Mm. So we have 10 brands and half of the business is Vogue. So you really don't want to mess that up, right? So everybody was sort of saying, ain't broke, you know, it ain't broke, leave it alone. But I knew what was coming. And so we had to speak to the brands. We had to try and ask them to be different. We had to say, you are going to need to make samples in different sizes. We can create content for you because your ad is now going to look slightly strange in the backdrop of this kind of melting pot of different races and sizes. And so I had to create a different business model for for Vogue, which invited in different brands to work with us, invited our existing brands to work differently, all so that we could bolster up this incredible vision where women felt seen and they felt like they weren't excluded, and that the idea that a magazine like Vogue didn't have to be excluding, it could be aspirational and inclusive, was radical creatively, but it was radical from a business perspective as well, because a lot of the times when people take those radical creative risks, it's with a platform which is not so big and not so visible and not so scary. And that first year, issue after issue, getting letters, you know, people taking the time to write letters or long emails to say, thank God, I finally see myself. This is amazing and was so gratifying. It just, you know, powered us on. But it was an amazing time and still is.
You've changed the world, would you say, as well, in fashion? Is that, do you see more runways with different models of different sizes and different shapes? You know, the friends that I've had who were in models, not many of them, but you just saw it was almost painful to see the relationship with food to being able to do their job, you know, to be able to...
I think we still have a lot of work to do there. Yeah. I definitely feel that British Vogue has changed the magazine world and the content world significantly. I remember the first September that we went... Rihanna was the first black woman, I believe, to be on the cover of British Vogue and for September
issue.
What year was that? That was 2020, you know, it's very recent. And, you know, every time we did these and people would say, that's the first or the first, and you'd say, my God, this is crazy. It's not like we're going for someone obscure. It's Rihanna, you know. And then I remember the subsequent September, after that first September issue, having a black woman on the cover, I went to the newsstands, as I do, and every single magazine cover had a black woman on it. And I thought, this is incredible, you know, because everybody thought, well, this is what we need to do now. And then I became a bit afraid that it was trend-based. So people were saying, what would Edward do? What would they do at Vogue? Right. And let's create the output without the work behind the scenes, talking to different people, having different people, create a real melting pot. And this idea of diversity of perspective is really important to me. It's one of the big criticisms when Edward was appointed and I was appointed was, you're going to appoint two black people, you know? So you it's like all or nothing. And lots of people felt it was kind of fad-like. And I had been at Condé Nast at that point for nearly a decade. I transformed GQ. I had, you know, a really... Jonathan Newhouse appointed me without interview to the job of running British Vogue based on my track record. But what people could see externally was, okay, they're doing a it's a thing. Mm-hmm. They're bringing in, you know. And so there was lots of criticism. It was quite shocking, actually, that people were quite vocal about it. And so when I saw those September covers, I initially thought, this is amazing. This is what we've always wanted. Mm-hmm. There are plus-size women and women of colour, and this is amazing. And then I looked at the masthead, and I thought, not very much has changed behind the scenes. And to really make the industry change, and really the new frontier is not who's on the cover, it's who works behind the scenes and how mixed is it.
If food is memory, and you have so many memories, and it's been so good hearing about this journey from Kenya to St. Kitts to the first floor of GQ and the top floor of Vogue, and food is all that. It's also comfort. And so the question we ask everybody is, if you need food for comfort, is there something you turn to when you do?
I'm going to pick two, if that's okay. One is pasta. We're in the River Cafe, of course. Mm. Isn't pasta the universal comfort food?
Well, certainly mine. Yeah.
I think almost everyone, a really good fresh pasta is just comfort. But food from my grandmother's kitchen is my ultimate. It's the European food I love is like a kiss, amazing kiss. My grandmother's food is like the warm embrace.
Yeah.
And so I would have one of the things she would make for lunch were something called saltfish fritter. So it's, again, I think, from her mother, who's Portuguese. The Portuguese have a thing called bacalhau.
And Italians, too.
Yeah, salted cod. Mm. In St. Kitts, my grandmother would make saltfish cakes from them, which is just mixed with eggs, onions, chives, peppers, chilies, and then fried into these patties. Mm. And you'd have that with plantain and some eggs. And it's absolutely divine.
Do you make it yourself?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, that's my comfort food that I make for myself. And it's slightly adapted. Yeah, but
I wish I'd met your grandmother.
She's amazing. Yeah. Well, you're kind of meeting her through me.
I am. Thank you so much. It was a beautiful conversation.
Thank you. Thanks, this is so special.
Thank you.
The River Cafe Lookbook is now available in bookshops and online. It has over 100 recipes beautifully illustrated with photographs from the renowned photographer Matthew Donaldson. The book has 50 delicious and easy-to-prepare recipes, including a host of River Cafe classics that have been specially adapted for new cooks. The River Cafe Lookbook, recipes for cooks of all ages. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.